The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong. The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
This is continuing coverage in the trial of Alex Murdaugh from True Crime Today.
That it is. My name is Tony Bruschi. Be sure to press subscribe wherever you're downloading podcasts so you don't miss any of our breaking updates and discussions on this case. Let's go back to the courtroom as the defense of Alex Murdaugh continues on with part two of their closing arguments.
All right, thank you. You may continue.
Thank you, Your Honor. Yesterday, in Mr. Waters' closing argument, he said that the evidence established that Paul and Maggie were murdered with family guns. I mean, that perhaps is his view of the evidence, but that's not a fact. In fact, the state's ballistic expert testified that the 12-gauge shot shells, as you found in the feed room, were fired by the same shotgun. That the shot shells, the things that rolled under the door, were fired by the same gun. That's all he testified to as the shotgun. Now, they have put a lot of guns in evidence here that have nothing to do with the crime. So we don't know what shotgun was used. It could have been a shotgun bought at Walmart that afternoon. It could have been a 20-year-old shotgun. But all the evidence, ballistic evidence, is shot shells were fired by the same gun. And that's... don't know that you really need an expert for that, but that's what the testimony was on the shotgun. With regard to the 300 blackout, you'll recall that this guy, Paul Greer, testified that the cartridges found at the crime scene, and Maggie was shot with a 300 blackout, that the tool marks, it's called tool marks, that the extractor and ejector marks from the cartridges found at the crime scene matched extractor and ejector tool marks on some cartridges found at the house and some found at the shooting range. And but what he didn't say was that where the firing pin breaches that cartridge, which is one of the most reliable indications, it did not match. No match. And he also did not compare projectiles. There was a projectile found. When I say projectile, that's the bullet. That's the bullet thing. It goes, that went into Maggie's body and broke up. But one went into the dog house and was found in the dog bed. And so they have that. And what they did not do is take that projectile and dig projectiles out of the berm where the shooting range was and compare it to see if they match. And that's the most reliable way to do it. Now, you know, in David Owen's notes, he said that the ballistic expert can't be 100% sure until you have the gun. And you heard my cross-examination of Agent Greer, and this tool mark ballistic examination is somewhat soft science, is come under criticism. It's what they rely upon. Not every investigative lab relies upon it. That's what they did here. But it's not gospel. It's not gospel. Another thing about the 300 blackout, he in his closing, Mr. Waters repeatedly said that A, Alec bought it, and I assume we're talking about the replacement, I don't know. Alec bought it. Well, Alec didn't buy it. The evidence in the record is Maggie bought it. And he kept saying, it's the defendants. And it's not the defendants. The replacement 3M blackout, which frankly no one had seen Paul with in quite some time except Will Loving on one occasion in sometime in March. It was Paul's gun. It wasn't Alec's gun. Paul's gun. At one point in time during his closing argument yesterday, Mr. Waters reenacted a shooting scenario, if you'll recall. And I'll do my best, but he stands up here and he says that Alec shoots Paul in the chest one time. And 999,999 times out of a million, that person is dead. He puts his shotgun down, and he has a 300 blackout right here because he is so smart and so diabolical that he's going to stage it so it looked like two shooters. So he's got a 300 blackout here, a shotgun that he just took his son out, but his son was one in a million, he says. One in a million comes this way, so Alec has to put the 300 blackout back down, pick up the shotgun, and shoot Paul. Where in the world does that scenario reside other than in Mr. Waters' mind? It doesn't. It doesn't. There's no evidence to support anything like that. None. None. And the fact that he has to go to such gymnastics to come up with a Alec staging a two-shooter theory ought to tell you there's a two shooters out there. Ought to tell you someone to do that. Another curious point in Mr. Waters' closing argument yesterday involves Paul's intuitive talents. You will recall that Alex informed agents that Paul was an intuitive little dude, referred to him as a detective, that Miriam Proctor, Maggie's sister, said that Maggie referred to Paul as his little detective, her little detective, and in particular when it came to trying to root out whether Alex was still doing drugs. And then he just sort of left it there. Sort of left it there for you to then take it and run with it as if, oh, Paul must have found Alec using drugs. There must have been a confrontation down there at the kennel. And that must have been what happened. Now he didn't go that far in his argument, but he laid it out there for you to run with. But that was clearly the implication. And I want to tell you first, there are no facts to support that. None whatsoever. Let me add another scenario that's equally as plausible. What if Paul, the detective, learned the source of drugs that were being sold to his dad? What if Paul, the detective, goes to that drug source, says, cut it out. That's my dad. You're ruining my family. And if you don't, I'm going to tell on you. Turn you in. And what if sources member of dangerous drug gang?
No, I'm legit.
Thanks.
Well, the point is, there's no more evidence to support it, and there was no evidence. Those were just plausible scenarios that they were throwing out to you, and that you could think up many equally plausible scenarios. But you have to decide the evidence based on the facts that the state puts before you. Not theories, not inferences, not speculation, but cold, hard facts. Mr. Waters also said that Alex, the master liar, accused Shelley, Smith, Blanca, and perhaps another witness of lying. He never did such a thing. He never accused anybody of lying from this witness stand. Now, I've been around long enough to know that witnesses can misremember things and believe them to be true. And frankly, I'm the biggest defender of that trait in my household. I convinced myself that I remembered something accurately, and I will have an argument with my wife until she shows me photographic evidence that I'm just wrong, and that's what it takes. I mean, that happens. People misremember things. But because we point out that there was an inconsistent fact, that doesn't mean we're saying someone lied. And we never did that. We never did that. The one example is Sister Marion. One example of misremembering. Sister Marion said that she spoke with Maggie about 7 p.m. while she was at Edisto, and that Alec wanted to come to Moselle to visit her father. Well, we know that her recollection is mistaken because we have cell phone records, we've got FBI records, we got her phone bill, we got that shows she was in Mount Pleasant and then she's traveling to Moselle around the period of time where Sister Marion thought she was at Edisto. Did not happen. That doesn't mean that she was lying about that. Absolutely not. That's just how she remembered it. And she also said that when she talked to Maggie, that Maggie was, you know, going to go over and visit Mr. Randolph at Alameda. But we know from the records that Mr. Randolph had already been readmitted to the hospital. I mean, that's in the records. And that Maggie knew it. We've got Maggie's text to Blanca, I think, in the day saying they're putting Mr. Randolph back in the hospital. You know, we're scared for everybody and hope Alec doesn't go down to the hospital. Well, no worries, I'm pointing it out. This is how Miriam remembered it. But if she remembered it incorrectly, and that happens. Because we point stuff out like that, we're not saying they're lying. Now, then the same with Shelley and the blue tarp. She remembers something. We're not sure what. But the evidence clearly is, she says it was on Wednesday, June 16th. And we got FBI cell phone forensics. We've got records. And we got testimony that Alec is in Somerville. He spent the night with his in-laws, the Branstetters, on Tuesday. And he stayed there toward the end of the week. And then they went to the mountains at Kiowee. So Alec could not have been knocking on the door of the Alameda house on the morning of June 16th. And Barbara Mixon came in and told you that she relieves Shelley. Shelley works all night, leaves, and goes to work at the school district. Barbara Ann comes in at 8 o'clock and relieves Shelley. And as Shelley recalled it, as the tarp was laid out when she left for work. Barbara Ann came in and said, I didn't see it. No time during that week that when I worked was there a blue tarp. You know, Shelley remembers something, but she's not a blue raincoat, and it's certainly Alec could not have come over there on Wednesday. Now Shelley also says that he spoke to me about times, and that bothered me. I called my brother. We're not disputing that, but what she didn't say is Alec told me to say I was here and 45 minutes or things like that, and frankly, it doesn't make a lot of sense because Alec kept saying, you get my phone records, and you'll know exactly what time I was when I was there. And I'll get to this a little bit more in a moment, but Mr. Waters keeps talking about, he's hurrying to get over there. He's hurrying to get over there to compress the time so that it looks like he's been gone from Moselle longer than he was. Fair enough argument. I understand his point, but that point evaporates when you're talking about how long you are at Alameda. It doesn't matter if he's there 45 minutes or 20 minutes. I mean, does it really matter how long he was there? Now, I guess before you had the OnStar data, they could be saying, he said he was there 45 minutes, but he's only there 22 minutes, and he spent the other 10, 15 minutes traipsing through the woods, burying bloody clothes and getting rid of murder weapons. Well, we may have heard that in this trial had we not gotten the OnStar data from General Motors in the middle of the trial, which shows conclusively he drove over there and he drove straight back. Another small point. He said there's biological material on the Polaris. I don't think that was ever tested. It certainly looks like it. But what we've learned in this case is things aren't always as they seem. They thought they had blood on the shirt. Turns out there's no blood on the shirt. And that this biological material showed that Maggie was running toward her baby. Now, I don't know that there's any evidence which way Maggie was running or what she was running to. There's not. I mean, it's a fair inference. And everyone who knows Maggie would know that's what she would do. And we're not disputing that would be her, that would be her mother instinct. And did that probably happen? It probably did. But it's just to state it as a fact, there's no evidence of that. Now, one thing he also said, the cell phone backlight turning on. And I don't have an Apple phone. But so here's the issue. And mine won't do it because I don't have an Apple phone, I don't think. But if you take a phone flat and pick it up, light comes on. And why is that important? Why is that important? Like I say, I probably turn this phone off. And if I'm making a point that you all know the answer to, I apologize, but it's important that you do know the answer to why this is important. It's important because now that we have the OnStar data, we know Alec drove his Suburban by the spot where Maggie's phone was found at 9:08. Now, there's probably some seconds in there, but 9:08. And we know that her phone is in the woods at that point. So the question is, did Alec throw it out the window at 9:08? And the answer is, no, he didn't. Because if you throw it out the window, at a minimum, the display light's going to come on. At a minimum. And when that display light comes on, it registers. These phones say a lot. Lesson learned in this case. It registers in this Knowledge C database, and it says, display light on. And it has a time that the display light came on. Well, on Maggie's phone, the display light does not come on at 9:08. Okay? So, means Alec didn't throw the phone out. And yesterday, Mr. Waters says, every single expert testified that the backlight comes on and sometimes it doesn't when the phone is raised aggressively. That's not true. Only one person testified to that. And Mr. Manigault, who, over the weekend, he works for Charleston County Sheriff's Department. I don't know why they didn't get Sladey to do it, but he got a phone similar to one that Maggie had, not Maggie's phone, had software, but not the same version as Maggie, and he spent all weekend throwing the phone on the ground to see what would happen. Or many hours of the day throwing the phone on the ground. And he comes in here and says, hey folks, sometimes the light comes on, sometimes it doesn't. Well, our expert, Mika Sturgis, says it comes on. It comes on. That's what we're talking about. That's what we're talking about. But folks, we wouldn't even be having this discussion if they had secured Maggie's phone and not allowed and put it in a Faraday bag so that the GPS coordinates on the 7th would not have been overridden. And they were. So now we got a guy down in Charleston throwing a phone around all weekend. Because they are desperate to prove Alec threw the phone out when he went by the room. They got no evidence of that. In fact, the evidence is the contrary. He did not. And the evidence supports everything that he had said from the day he had that interview or a couple of days. You get the OnStar data, you get GPS data, you get my GPS data, and you'll know I'm not traveling with her phone. Never got it, rode over it, and now we've got a guy tossing a phone in an office, doesn't even work for SLED. Not every expert says that. The guys even said that's not his area of expertise. So, let me see if I've hit all. Oh, yeah. The last one's about me. Mr. Waters says that I did an HBO interview in November 2022, and he references some things I said in the HBO interview. Well, I didn't, and he knows I didn't. It was testified about. There's an HBO special. I am on it. I'm not telling anybody to watch it, but that was filmed back in, I don't know, spring, summer of 2022. I'm well before he was charged with murder. I'm not on TV talking about his murder charges, but he wants you to think that, and I don't know why, and I took a little bit of offense to that. I really did.
And we object, because he was.
I was not being interviewed.
Objections overruled.
Not being interviewed in November of 2022. Not. So I've asked why they can't answer that. They don't have an answer as to why. Now how? How? How could Alec, in the time period we know we're gonna get to it, but how could he have butchered Maggie and Paul without leaving a trace of evidence within a matter of minutes? How? We went from why, now how? And the answer to the how is he couldn't. But this is the wrong question to be asking yourselves. Because the question that you are tasked with answering is, has the state presented evidence that proves beyond a reasonable doubt showing that Alec butchered Maggie and Paul without leaving a trace of evidence, all within a matter of minutes? In a matter of minutes. Have they proven evidence? Do they present evidence of that? Proof beyond a reasonable doubt. He was able to make bloody clothes, bloody guns. Who knows how much? Whatever. Disappear in a matter of minutes. Without leaving a trace. Of course they haven't. A reasonable doubt is doubt that causes a reasonable person to hesitate in one of the most important decisions of your life. And here, there's no direct evidence of Alec doing anything other than he's at the kennel, 8:44, and this is just pleasant family talking about Bubba the dog getting a chicken. So the state's trying to weave this story of his guilt based upon circumstantial evidence. And the judge will charge you on circumstantial evidence, and I have no dispute with what the state put up here yesterday, because that's the law, and you're going to get it. He's going to give you the written document with the charge. And you will see in there that when they rely upon circumstantial evidence, it's as good as direct evidence, but there's some things that it has to do to be as good as direct evidence. And what it has to do, the circumstantial evidence, is that the circumstances must be consistent with each other, and when taken together, point conclusively to the guilt of the accused beyond a reasonable doubt. If these circumstances portray the behavior of a defendant as suspicious, the proof has failed. That's circumstantial evidence. So what are the circumstances that the state relies upon? Well, he was at the kennel at 8:44. Paul last used his phone at 8:48. He replied to a text with a friend about a movie recommendation. Maggie's phone locked for the last time at 8:50, actually at 8:49 and 50-some odd seconds, but 8:50. However, her phone recorded significant steps around 8:55, and we're going to see that, and her phone tried to activate the camera at 8:55, and it registered an orientation change at 9:06. And I think you pretty much understand an orientation change, but when the phone goes from landscape to portrait, or this is, that beats me, but goes from that to that, that is an orientation change. And the phone will tell you. So it did that at 9:06. And they've got 300 shell casings, extractor and ejector markings matched with casings found around the house and shooting range. So that's pretty much it. and then of the circumstantial evidence of his guilt. Now, they want to say, well, he lied about it, so it's consciousness of guilt, but I'm talking about what evidence they have, put all the circumstances together, prove he shot and killed Maggie Paul, and that's pretty much it. And how have they established the time of death here? Solely on cell phone use. Solely on cell phone use. And using the phone or not using the phone doesn't dictate or define whether you're dead or alive. I mean, I'd say most everybody in this courtroom does not have their phone with them right now. Under the state's theory, as I mentioned before, you know, if they die while they're not using their phone, then they're dead the moment they stop using their phone. That's what they have here. That is their case. There are a number of reasons that Paul would stop using his phone. First, I got two testimonial clips, one from Rogan. Remember Rogan Gibson, if you'll play that quickly, Doug. This is Rogan testifying about Paul's phone.
You asked a little bit about Paul's cell phone usage. He was on it a lot.
He was on it a lot, yes, sir.
Yeah. And
And did the battery get down?
Okay. All right. What is the objection?
Not showing the witness, showing the defendant while the witness is testifying. I think the testimony
was the legal basis for the objection.
That is correct.
All right. Mr. Griffin.
A clip from the live feed of this trial, Your Honor. I can't control who is being depicted, but it's the voice, my voice asking Rogan.
Been in trial how many weeks?
6 weeks.
So we're not going to replay the trial.
That's right. It's a clip of a few seconds.
I sustain the objection.
All right, take it down, Doug. So you will remember that Rogan said that when Paul's phone, and by the way, if you don't remember and you have questions about it, when you're in jury deliberations, you can always ask to have testimony replayed for you through. John, can we play the audio without the video?
You're asking me,
yes.
What can you do? I rule on objections.
Can you play the audio then, please?
You asked a little bit about Paul's cell phone usage. He was on it a lot.
He was on it a lot, yes, sir.
Yeah. And did the battery get down low pretty regularly?
Yes, he would let his phone die sometime or he would lose it.
Well, and when it would get down low, did he have a habit of, you know, not using it to try to keep him going all the way up?
Yes, I have seen that happen before.
And have you done that yourself?
Yes, sir.
All right, and so you'll know from the photographs and the evidence in the case that Paul's phone was at 2%, and it was on low power mode at the time. He was texting this friend of his about a movie recommendation. And then can you play the audio only of, you remember Nate Tootin, and he testified about Paul putting the phone down when he was working around the kennels.
And how would you describe the relationship between Paul and Alex?
They had a really good relationship.
Would you say that Alex?
I don't think that's the right clue. So there's Mr. Tootin testified that when Paul would work, he would put the phone down, forget where it was at times, and that it was pretty common for him to put the phone down at the kennel so he wouldn't get it wet. And you recall Dale Davis, they brought him to the stand. I think they brought him to the stand to make it seem like the hose was unraveled and then it was used and put back. And we know from the video, and you can see it again, the dog kennel video, we pointed out the hose is on the ground. outside Cassius Kennels. And Mr. Davis says, yeah, that, you know, that was not how I left it. Someone had put it down. And then, I'm going to
show you.
Got it right here. Doug, can I have the Elmo, please? Awful.
Just give it to me, please.
Ladies and gentlemen, you'll have back in the jury room State's Exhibit 503, which is a picture of the dog kennels from the murder scene. And what I'm pointing out on top of these two kennels are dog beds. You'll see, Exhibit 503, the dog beds are up here on top. And you recall Dale Davis says that when you clean out the kennels, hose it down, you put the dog beds on top. On top. So it's pretty clear from these photos, this photo, that Paul and or Maggie had sprayed out those dog runs and put the dog beds on top and put the hose away. Alec testified that the Bubba and Grady had on collars, and we see the collars in States 45. And so their collars hanging here, but their collars hanging here, and then there's collars here, and the dogs don't have collars on them in the dog picture. So it's a fair conclusion that after Alec left, when he said he left, that Paul puts Bubba up, Paul puts Grady up, after cleaning out the kennels, and then he goes back into the feed room to get his phone where he was confronted. Or sometime later it happened. I don't know. But they are relying upon cell phone usage for time of death. The coroner said he did the armpit test, which is no test at all. It's just a guesstimate. Can you pull up in evidence? Now I want to talk about Maggie's phone and defendant's exhibit 158, please. So this is Maggie's phone timeline that we put in evidence, and this is going from 8:49 to 9:07, and if you'll just walk through it. You'll see at 8:49:26, last text message read by Maggie. Okay, go to the next one. 8:49:28, backlight off. Go to the next one. 8:49:31, phone locks and remains locked until recovery by law enforcement. It was locked for the last time and never unlocked. 8:53, but on 8:53, the backlight comes on. Backlight comes on. It's being manipulated. 8:53:12, orientation to portrait starts. 8:53:15, phone begins logging 59 steps. 8:53:20, there's a Siri usage, and the testimony is you can get that by squeezing the button. 8:53:24, orientation portrait completes. So it switches. And then 8:53:28, backlighting is off. Next, backlight is on. Backlighting is off again. And it's on again. Keep going. And then 8:54:34, camera use starts. It's activated by touching the camera icon or by swiping left from the lock screen. The there was a question as to whether that could be from facial recognition. And Lieutenant Dove said that information resides in the Knowledge C database, but he did not look for it. Michael Sturgis, our expert, looked for it, found it, and came and told you that was not a facial recognition miss. It was from intentionally activating the phone only for 1 second. Go to the next slide. Camera usage ends. Go to the next slide. Orientation of landscape starts. 8:54:44, it ends. And then 8:55, so the point is there's a lot going on with Maggie's phone at around 8:55. Keep going. Keep going. And then at 9:03, the backlight goes off. And at 9:04, there's a missed call from Alex. And at 9:04:23, the backlight's off. And 9:04:41, the missed call from Alec ends. So let's back up to, let's go to 9:04:23, missed call from Alex. Okay. And this was the testimony on 9:04:23, and it's important. Alex calls Maggie. And when that happens, you would, her backlight was on. Go back one more. So her backlight is on at 9:03:52. At 9:04, missed call from Alex starts. At 9:04:23, and instantaneously, the backlight goes off. Now you heard the testimony of that is means when that call came in, someone pushed on the side to stop the call. Now was that done by Maggie because she was over on the other side of the workshop where we see those footprints that we heard about that were never really analyzed, and that she didn't want any noise coming through? Or was that some bad guy or bad person has Maggie's phone and stops the call? But something's going on with her phone at 9:04. I'll tell you that. And then at 9:04, the next one is missed call from Alex ends. 9:05, backlight on. 9:06, orientation changes to portrait. 9:07, incoming call from Alex. 9:06, 14. Keep going, Doug. And 9:06:52, keep going. And then at 9:07, her phone stops for good. Now, one of the things that you heard in this case is that orientation change was at 9:06 that we just talked about. And Doug, if you'll go to the if you go to Defendants 156, please. And so these are Alex's steps on his phone that were registered during this time period. And if you'll go to entry, if you look at entry 28, and if you'll pull that out, Doug. All right. So 28, this is between 9:02:18 and 9:06:47. And this is the time period that Mr. Waters in his argument said was scurrying around because he took, Yeah, just bring it back a little bit more, please. So we, can we do it so we can see the whole line? Just that's fine. So that so here we see line 28 between 902 and 906. There's 283 steps, and it went 208 meters. So I want you to first, and so they take the position that this is him scurrying around. But if you do the math, which we haven't done here on this document, but 283 steps in 269 minutes, excuse me, 269 seconds, turns out to be 1.05 steps per second. 1.05 steps per second. Multiply that by 60, you get 63 steps per second. And if, ladies and gentlemen, this is a slow walk, one step per second. 1,001, 1,002, 1,003, 1,004, 1,005. This is Alex scurrying around, according to the state's case. And if you look at the distance in meters of the last, when he gets, I guess, to the house at 755 to 855, he goes 203 meters before it stops registering. And then one thing you will remember during this time period, between 902 and 906, at 906, Maggie's phone has an orientation change. Her phone has moved from here to here. But what her phone doesn't have, go to the second page. What her phone doesn't have are steps. Our steps. And Lieutenant Dove testified that, yeah, it doesn't look like anyone like when, that her phone is moving at 906, but there's no steps being registered. Alec is walking from 902 to 906. So it would bear to reason that Maggie is not, excuse me, Alec is not walking with Maggie's phone. That's the timeline data that I wanted to review with you. The if you'll go to Exhibit 524, Defense Exhibit 524, please. I think it's, yeah, States 524. I'm sorry. Do you have that? So if you'll go to the slide where not 38. Do you have the whole document or you don't? Oh, yeah, we'll drop that. Drop that. Okay. Well, the I mentioned earlier, and so States Exhibit 524 is all the OnStar data. You will see there that he goes by the spot at 908 where Maggie's phone was found. And there was testimony that he sped up after he went by there. He sped up to like from 42 to 45 and went back down to 44 miles an hour when he went by there. He's not speeding up when he goes by the area where Maggie's phone was found, whenever it was tossed. And then they have, you know, a chart or slide that talks about how long it took him to get over there and the speeds that it took. And Mr. Waters was arguing to you that compressed the timeline. The faster he gets over to Alameda, it means that he's gone longer from Moselle, and it gives him a better alibi because, as you know, he's orchestrating this alibi. And so he's driving fast over to Almeida, according to their theory, and we graphed it out, and he's driving, he's passing some cars, and he is, you know, he's a fast driver. Okay, so they say, oh, he's compressing the timeline. Compressing the timeline is what they say. Compressing the timeline. But then they say, he drives fast on the way back. Why? He's driving the same speed over there, same speed back. There's no reason to compress the timeline coming back. I mean, you'd want to be driving slow as you can to make it appear you've been gone a lot longer. I mean, he drives the same speed from Moselle to Almeida as from Almeida back to Moselle. It takes him the same amount of time. He's not compressing any timeline at all. And what's the most curious part about Maggie's phone? About Maggie's phone? What's most curious about it is Alec has her password. Alec, if he is wanting to change the timeline, when he calls her phone, he should answer her phone. When he texts her, he should reply to that text to show activity on her phone that she's still alive. If he is manufacturing a timeline by speeding, the easiest way to do it is use both phones, talk on both phones, and he did it. This whole thing about using Maggie's phone, driving Maggie's phone, throwing Maggie's phone out is, it's such a stretch for them to come in and try to put her phone in his hand. And then you start thinking through, why would Alec take her phone and not Paul's phone? Let's start there. Why would Alec take her phone and not Paul's phone? That's a question I don't have an answer to. It makes no sense. It makes no sense why he would take Maggie's phone, if there's something on there, he knows her password, put it in, see what it is. We know from all this phone data, her phone was never unlocked. And he had the keys. So if he's taking her phone to unlock or to do something with it, he didn't. And so why? And these are circumstances that have to be consistent with each other and have to point conclusively to the guilt of Alec Murdoch, beyond a reasonable doubt. And these circumstances just raise more questions, ladies and gentlemen, raise more questions that we wouldn't have to be dealing with if they had just simply secured Maggie's phone in a Faraday bag on June the 8th when they got it. We wouldn't be here. So we do know from the timeline that Alec left the property at 9:07. Were they killed before he left? I don't know the answer to that. But we do know that if he was in the house when the shots were made down at the kennel, that he would not have heard them. We had decibel testing from Mr. Sutton. Now they were angry with Mr. Sutton's angle test. They were angry, not angry, but they challenged his conclusions on a lot of things. But they didn't touch his acoustic testing. Didn't doubt that. Haven't challenged that. And so if he's in the house and shots are going down, ringing down at the kennel, he doesn't hear them. Now, they say that sometime after 8:44, and they peg it 8:48, 8:50, because that's when Paul last responded to a text from this friend of his, but they ignore the fact that it had to be cleaned up, and I think Buster testified that takes 10 minutes at least to get the dogs in, clean up, et cetera. And then there's all this 8:55 stuff going on Maggie's phone, but let's take him at their theory at 8:50, after having a pleasant conversation, talking about is it a guinea or is it a chicken, and Bubba, you know, and getting, I mean, all right, so 4 minutes later, let's go ahead and kill my wife and my son because I got questioned at office today by Jeannie Secretary. Okay, that's their case. So let's run with it and see where it takes us. Well, it takes us that he leaves the property at 9:07. So from the moment, so if he's got, you know, if it happens at 8:50, he's got 17 minutes. 17 minutes. He would have to be a magician to make all that evidence disappear. As you heard, under either Dr. Kinsey or Mr. Palmbach, Dr. Raymer and Dr. Kinsey, Mr. Palmbach and Dr. Eisenstadt, either way, the shooter's covered with blood on Paul's shooting. And that's what all that testimony was about. It wasn't about trying to figure out who's got the right angles. The whole point of that is, while we ended up having to get our own experts, is to prove the shooter is covered in biological material, covered in blood, covered in everything, because of the blowback. And it wasn't until on reply that Dr. Kennedy said, oh, well, there'd be blowback under my version, too. Blowback meaning blood, biological material from killing Paul. So the shooter's covered in blood. The shooter's gun is covered in blood. And that, there's not sufficient amount of time to clean all that up, make all that disappear. And then call your son Buster, driving to visit your mother, who he had gotten a call from Barbara Mixon earlier today and said your mother's agitated because your dad went back in the hospital and you might want to check on her. He goes to check on her. He calls Buster. And as he say, hey, Bus, I just blew your mom and brother up. You should see the damn mess. Are you kidding me? He calls Chris Wilson. Normal conversation. He calls his brother John Marvin, talking about his dad. And then he goes over there and he sits down with Shelly and sits on his mom's dad. And he stays there 20 minutes, not 40 minutes or 22 minutes. I don't know. The records show what time. But the fact of the matter is, he's got no blood on him. He's acting normal as every day. He is the same old Alec. Yet, their theory is he just blew the people he loved the most in this world, blew them away. Now, talk a little bit about the angles that Mr. Sutton did, his reverse trajectories on the shots, and I mean they're having a good time joking about the size of the figure in the Pharaoh, saying, "Oh, it must have been a 12-year-old kid. And it's 5'2", 5'4", and you know." Let them have their fun, but that's not what the testimony was. Testimony was that the barrel of the gun has to be at that level to make the shot into the quail pen. We didn't take the measurements. Sled took the measurements. And so, yeah, could a 6'4 person get down to that level? Sure. And all Mr. Sutton says, that's not a natural shooting angle. Could a 6'4 person get on their knees? Sure. Shooters are in movement, and a 6'4 person is going to be moving around on their knees? I don't think so. But, you know, the most common sense thing here is there were two shooters. Because there were two guns, and as Mr. Palmbach said, one gun is high capacity, holds 10, 20, 30 rounds. And if you're going down to execute somebody, one gun's enough. Why take another gun that only has three shots. It's and Dr. Kinsey agreed with the angle coming out of the bird, the quail pen, so that the angle puts it pretty far away from the door of the feeder room where Paul's killed. But it's not our burden. It's not our burden. It's their burden to prove to you, based on circumstantial evidence, that all the circumstances are consistent with each other and point conclusively to the defendant's guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. And those facts are just not consistent. Those facts are just not consistent. I'm going to say a word about condition of Paul and Maggie, particularly Paul. I'm not going to show you any photos. But I think you would agree that it was so bad. It was so bad. And Alec, in the back of the car, me in the back of that, you could see me on the camera, sitting there talking to Agent Owen and Agent Craw, and he says it was so bad, they did him so bad. Agent Croft misheard that and said, he said, I did him so bad. And I think the evidence is everyone who's listened to it and everyone who knows what Alex was talking about around that time says they did him so bad. And Agent Owen was in the car, and he doesn't say to you, oh, he actually said, I did him so bad. I think we can put that issue to rest, but that issue points to a bigger question. What would they be saying in this trial if that conversation wasn't videotaped? What would they be saying? We know Agent Croft would be saying, he said, I did him so bad. And then where would we be then? I am grateful to SLED that they videotaped that. So that you'll hear it if you have any questions. I don't think you should, but they did him so bad. That is for sure. Another thing that we're going to clear up right now is Alex's concern for Buster. You heard that, and you heard that in Mr. Waters' closing. That in statements that Alec made on the roadside shooting in Labor Day weekend, where he tried to arrange an assisted suicide, that he told officers that there's no danger to Buster. Of course, there was no danger to Buster because of that roadside shooting, because he knew who shot him, Curtis Eddie Smith. He knew he was trying to get himself killed. But from that, there's going, the reason he knows there's nothing to worry about Buster is because he knows he did it. That's what was just argued yesterday. Well, Deputy McDowell, in a body cam video that's in evidence, captured Alec speaking to Buddy Hill about his concern about Buster's safety. Will you play that now, Doug? It's in evidence. I don't have the exhibit number. Get a police officer for my oldest son in Columbia. What about Buster? What about Buster? Can y'all get a police officer for my oldest son? Buddy, can y'all get a police officer for my oldest son in Columbia? That's Buddy Hill, the sheriff. And they won't come in here and tell you he wasn't concerned for Buster's safety? Once again, I'm grateful Colleton County Sheriff's Department had body cams. Now you know. You know Alec was concerned. You know Alec asked for a police officer for his son in Columbia, Buster. Now I'm almost done, I promise. But I do want to talk about Alec's misstatements about time. Alex told Deputy Owen during interviews that, well, first, Alec's statements about time are not lies. They are just misstatements. And even, like I said, Deputy Owen says people make mistakes about all the Agent Owen. I'm sorry, Agent Owen. They make mistakes about time all the time. And they do. Now, Mr. Waters is critical because Alec was wrong every time he gave a time estimate. Turns out, I think Mr. Waters is probably right about that. Whether the time period is inconsequential or consequential, he's wrong about it. And the and we had brought in, you know, Alec had told deputies in an interview that he got home at 5 o'clock, and that's not true. That he went to work that day at 8:30, that's not true. And so he is just wrong on times. But what was consistent, whenever he had an interview, he said, you get the records, and it will show what time I did this, what time I did that. It will all be in the records. And guess what? They are in the records. And when the records show that his time estimate was wrong, you know, they jump up and down. The statement to Deputy Green, he says, I've gone to my mom's for about an hour and a half, and I last saw them 45 minutes. Now that I don't know. I frankly, Frank, don't know if that's wrong or not. I mean, he's talking to Deputy Green about 10:30. Hour and a half from 10:30 is 9 o'clock. I mean, he left. He left at 9:07. But that's that. The question about what he did when he got down to the scene, and he said he ran up to Paul and Maggie, and he left his phone, and then went back to get his phone, and then he's talking to the 911 operator, and you can hear it, and he says, I've been up to it now. It's bad. He doesn't remember the sequencing, and I don't think anyone should hold that against him. You know, Mr. Waters gets up here and says, Maggie was running to her baby. Alec was running to his baby. And can you imagine what he saw? And is it evidence of guilt that he doesn't remember what the sequencing was in that moment? Is that evidence of guilt? Or is that evidence of trauma? This is a guy that then went to get a 12-gauge shotgun, and he put 16-gauge shells in it. He knows the difference, but he didn't know that night. And I'm not quite understanding what the state makes of this. Did he not go up to their bodies? Because the forensic evidence sure speaks to the contrary. What we have is Maggie's DNA all over his T-shirt. And you heard that from Agent Zapata. We have Paul's DNA on his T-shirt. How did he get Paul and Maggie's DNA on his T-shirt if he didn't touch them? If he brutally murdered them, hosed off down there next to their dead bodies, got in a golf cart butt naked, drove to the house, changed clothes, went over to his mom's, goes down, calls 911, Then searches for Whaley restaurant menu and checking emails, waiting for the police to show up. How's he get their DNA on his body? Because it's on there. Their forensic lab tells you that. Because he went up to them and touched them. And then there's a spot of blood on the Suburban steering wheel that was Maggie's. And we know that the Suburban was never down at the kennel, thanks to the OnStar information. Thanks to, I'm not sure that was an accepted fact until OnStar sent their stuff in, but the Suburban never went down to the kennel until after he returned back from Moselle. So we know the blood got on the steering wheel after he checked Maggie like he said he did on the 911 call. And then there's a spot of blood on the gun that he went to get. And then there's GSR. There's three particles of GSR on his shirt, three particles of GSR on his shorts, and one on his finger. And the SLED agent testified that's consistent with transfer GSR when you pick up a gun. So, but really, we're back to the lie. We are back to the lie. Because that's all they have in this case, is that Alec lied to them when he last saw them. And he shouldn't have. And he shouldn't have. And he said, what a tangled web we weave once we start to deceive. And once he lied the first time, he was stuck with the lie, and he continued to lie. And he shouldn't have. He shouldn't have. And he told you, you know, what was going through his mind. Probably wasn't rational, but he was in the throes of an addiction, and he had just found his wife and son murdered. And he's being interviewed. He'd been swiped for GSR. And he does think David Owen is the guy that investigated his friend. But he was wrong, and he told you. Turns out he was wrong. But I thought that's who it was that night. And he was under investigation. He was being accused of obstructing the boating accident investigation. And he's under investigation by SLED for that. And he had all these skeletons in his closet. And he was wanting to get them away from him and looking for the real killer. The state in this case has gone to lengths trying to, through a sleight of hand, convince you of this and show you that, and without convince you of guilt, without showing evidence of guilt, convince you that he murdered his wife and son because of financial misdeeds were going to come out, which is about the most illogical thing imaginable, and there's no evidence of that. And then the state brings all these shotguns in here, and I'm not going to pick every one of them up, but the forensic evidence on these shotguns is they can't be excluded. Well, okay. They can't be included either, so you know nothing more about these shotguns than you would have the day you showed up for jury selection, because there's nothing to know about them. Can't exclude them, can't include them according to them, but we do know there's no blood, guts, brains on any of the guns that would have been there from the shooting under everybody's interpretation of how Paul was murdered. They want you to think that because you own guns that you should be viewed differently. I don't know what else to make of that. When this trial began with opening statements on January 25th, Mr. Harpootlian asked, why? Why? Why would Alex execute his wife and son in cold blood? And here we are, 6 weeks later. And you've heard weeks' testimony about Alex's financial crimes, drug addiction, and lies. But after all that, The state has failed to prove, to provide a satisfactory answer to this question. Why? The state cannot provide an answer to this question because the answer is he would not, under any circumstances, murder those that meant the most to him. Your oath requires that you hold the state to the exacting standard of proof that the state must prove the defendant's guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. And when they rely solely on circumstantial evidence, these circumstances must be consistent with each other. And when taken together, point conclusively to the guilt of the accused beyond a reasonable doubt. And if they merely portray the behavior of the defendant as suspicious, you must find him not guilty. The state's evidence fails to meet these requirements. Circumstances don't point conclusively to Alex's guilt. Far from it. Mr. Waters wants you to believe that Alex slaughtered Maggie and Paul on June 7th and repeatedly lied and changed his story to fit the timeline and evidence. As it turns out, in fact, the state is the one that's been manipulating evidence to fit their theories of guilt, which changed over time from the date of these murders until yesterday. In the absence of forensic science, a reliable investigation, the guns, blood spatter, the time and opportunity to have committed these murders, you're instead left to make inferences about all sorts of interactions and behaviors. Prosecution wants you to view the evidence through the diabolical monster lens that they have tried to paint, but the law requires you to view it through the lens of innocence, where none of these things, individually or taken together, prove conclusively to Alex's guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. Up until now, you've not been able to say a single word. Can't imagine how frustrating that must be. But soon you will have the most powerful voice in this courtroom. With your words, you can let everyone know that in a court of law, only evidence and the burden of proof matters. Not gossip, innuendo, opinions, and most of all, not theories layered on top of speculation. With your words, you can let the state know that they don't get to obtain an indictment by misleading a grand jury and then bring you before you a case built on theories, speculation. There are two words that justice demands in this case, and those two words are not guilty. The oath you've taken in this case is to follow the law, to follow the Constitution, and to hold the government to the burden of proof. And it requires a verdict of not guilty. On behalf of Alex, on behalf of Buster, on behalf of Maggie, and on behalf of my friend Paul, I respectfully request that you do not compound a family tragedy with another. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, we'll send you to the jury room for a break. Please do not discuss the case.
That wraps up that segment. There is more to come from the courtroom, and we will bring it to you as it happens right here. Be sure to press subscribe so you don't miss any of our updates. I'm Tony Bruschi. Stay with us.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong. The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong. The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
You have 5 new messages.
Hey, Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week?
Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today.
Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.